Very happy to have Chip join me this morning as we move into the sermon portion of our service. To say a little bit about our upcoming pledge drive, the importance of it, the role he's taken in it. And Chip, I appreciate you agreeing to be with for a second year. I need to retrieve a little something while you speak.
Okay,
go right ahead.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Thank you. It's an honor to get to share the pledge drive again this year. And it is also a great pleasure that I am passing that baton for next year to new grandmother Ellen Fisher. So thank her. Before I start with some comments, I just want to thank the quite large and incredibly energetic committee that helped make this pledge drive possible. Mike Ballantyne for his work on the web, Carol Thorpe, who's created a pretty remarkable graphic that we'll see both on the web and in the coffee hour. Kate Messner, Shirley Rayburn, and Nona Storer who put the pledge packets together, the materials for that. Erica Constantino, Chelsea Constantino, Kathy Fletcher, and Jennifer Lees for making their always spectacular food. Ellen Fisher and Mary Markle for helping put together the seventh generation dinners. Rosalie Kuhn, who will be the pen behind the thank you notes that you receive as your pledges come in. John Orr, Billy Parker, Steve Hedges, Rob Taylor for helping out. Steve Eddington for helping put this service together. Very importantly, Sherry Woolsey for making every idea actually turn into an actual happening. Lori Goodman as president, I'd like to thank in particular Mary and Kate for putting up with this while we're dealing with family. I also had thought about using Lori's a story that Lori shared with me about the trees in Oxford as this opening, but decided not to. That's a good story from Lori, and so ask her about generations of planning in Oxford at some point, because it's a pretty remarkable story. However, I did want to stick on the theme of trees. And so I'm going to open this year with the opening remarks and also with some thoughts that I have about a metaphor using trees. Again this year, our pledge drive theme is based on the many generations of our church history. We are reminded of the connections in this community that are quiet, mysterious, slowly built, and persistent. Connections that spread across generations. This was the theme that we liked so much from last year that we decided to use it again. You might look at it as the pledge drive's committee to recycling. To start this year's drive, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about a metaphor that I have in mind. You see, I'm a novice gardener. I enjoy working in the garden, and I like producing something real, usually something that you can eat. That's why I chose that passage from Marge Percy for the chalice lighting. She's writing about gardening when she says, "Connections are made slowly. Sometimes they grow underground. You cannot tell always by looking what is happening." The garden I do in February and March is maple sugaring. I tap my neighbor's trees. I do ask them for permission first. And then on sunny days, I sap collects in buckets and I can boil it down into syrup in my backyard. The great thing about maple sugaring is the timing. Everything is backwards. Usually in gardening, you work and sweat through the spring and summer. You dig and prepare and plant and tend and water and weed and water and weed and water and weed. And then finally, you get your reward. Your tomatoes, your cucumbers, your string beans by August or September. That can be a long wait, particularly in February when you look out at the snowbanks. With maple sugaring, however, you get to harvest first thing in the spring. You get it before you have to do anything, any of the hard work that you do in a garden. In fact, most of the hard work's already done for you. The digging and planting and tending and watering and weeding happened over 50 years ago, sometimes after 100 years for some of the glorious old trees that I have the privilege to tap. And that's where the metaphor is for me. Someone in 1908 planted a scrawny row of maple saplings out on Concord Street. The little trees that lined a drive up to what was then a new house. The person didn't know any of us. He never benefited from the sap that now flows out of those trees in early March, or the shade that they produce in the summer, or the foliage each fall. And I think the pledge drive is like maple sugaring. We enjoy this community because of the hard work and generosity of those that came before us. We pledge not just to keep the heat on through the next year, but also to plant the seeds for the benefit of those we do not know yet, many of whom we will never know. To start the pledge drive this year, the church's lay leadership, including the executive board, committee chairs, and leading financial supporters, have already pledged generously. 13 families pledged before the drive even started. Today, we ask you to get into the act. Your pledge packets are available in the dining room for you to pick up after the service. We ask that all members submit their pledge by April 20th to allow the executive board time to budget for the upcoming year. Last year, we set a record with the pledge amounts, but we're not all the way to our goal yet. We need to continue to lessen our dependence on the endowment. This year, we have set the goal for having 180 pledgers, that's individuals or families, pledged to the church. Please consider what you can give and pledge generously. I think the metaphor between sugaring and pledging holds as Marge Percy ends her poem. Is she writing about tapping trees? Or is she writing about her community? When she writes, penetrate quietly as the earthworm that blows no trumpet. Fight persistently as the creeper that brings down the tree. Spread like the squash plant that overruns the garden. Gnaw in the dark and use the sun to make sugar. Even across generations, the mystery remains that we are connected, even when we feel apart. Thank you.
Chip, thank you very much. It was really, really wonderful, wonderful work. And appreciate the work you have put in both this year and the past year. And I do join with Chip in urging all of you to support this pledge drive to the extent that you're able to do so, which is what I'm going to talk about for the next few moments myself. I can still remember pretty well the first pledge drive in which I ever participated. Believe it or not, I was all of 13 years old, and I was a canvasser in my church's every member canvas. And when they said they were going to have an every member canvas, they met every single member. And since I had been baptized at the tender age of 10, I was considered not just a member, and but I was a pledger and was asked to be a canvasser for my youth group. So my job in the 1958 pledge drive, that's 50 years ago for those of you who may be doing the math, was to visit some of the other younger people in my junior high youth group to get them to make a pledge for the upcoming church year. Now this was literally a nickel and dime effort. A dollar a week was not a bad allowance in that day and at that time, and 10 cents a week represented a tithe, or 10% of one's income. Now, this suggested share was based on the 28th chapter of the book of Genesis, where one of the Hebrew patriarchs by the name of Jacob promises Yahweh a one-tenth return of all the worldly blessings that God had bestowed upon him. Well, if you took that seriously, which these folks did, that made pledging to the guidelines pretty simple. It was 10%, whatever you took in a given year. So some 3,000 years after this initial pledge drive, there I was riding my bicycle around Salem, West Virginia, seeing how many dime-a-week pledges I could secure. Now, I don't recall how successful I was. The church must have met or come close to its goal because it continued to survive and grow. I do remember being glad that my friends remained my friends, even after I'd lightened their wallets to the tune of 5 or 10 cents a week. And actually, I have to say that nobody, neither my fellow youth group members nor their parents, ever gave me any grief or any kind of flack about what I was doing. Because, you see, I was from the church. And what I was doing was for the church. And in that cultural setting at that time, that was all the validation I needed, even at the age of 13. Well, I can see how my recounting of such an episode in such a time might set off some liberal alarm bells, might send a few UU red flags flying. Isn't that terribly exploitive? Sending kids out barely in their teens to shake down the allowances of other kids for a pledge campaign. Using a 10% figure based on some obscure biblical reference. My answer to the word is no, or maybe two words, not really. Because that campaign gave my friends and gave me a sense that we were participating in a larger effort. The church at that time wasn't even 10 years old, and it needed all the help it could get. It had a very firm sense of its mission, who it was, where it wanted to go, and that was shared right down to the youngest members. And while I'd been attending that church for several years, ever since I was a real little kid, I now have, after that pledge drive, it kind of became my church in a way that it hadn't been before. I now had a personal and financial statement. And as for that Jacob and Yahweh business, well, the story communicated the idea that we were really involved in something that ultimately went beyond the mechanics of a fundraising effort. What we were doing had something to do with the mission of that church, and with the God who was very real to all the people who were a part of that congregation. And on this point, for just a moment, I feel a need to dispel an urban legend or a myth that we religious liberals seem to like to tell ourselves when the subject of money for religious purposes comes up. In all the pledge drives I was ever involved in or witnessed during that much, much earlier stage of my life, at no time did I ever hear the wrath of God or the punishment of hell invoked as a way of threatening those who did not sufficiently pledge. I hear this urban legend, as I'm calling it, get floated around in liberal religious circles now and then, probably as a way of assuring ourselves, I guess, that we are not like them when it comes to money matters. No, the reasons given for pledges are the same ones that we're doing here. They were very positive ones. And they always came with the caveat that you should do the best you could, because God knows your financial situation better than any canvasser or pledge drive, and even Jacob himself probably had a bad year once in a while. Well, to close on this part of the sermon, today that same church owns a goodly portion of the city block where it first erected its very modest building over 60 years ago. Part of its large physical plant now involves a gymnasium that houses various neighborhood recreational activities for kids who live in that area. And believe it or not, I find it hard to believe, but I find this out when I visit home to see my mother once in a while. We'll be celebrating her 83rd birthday here not too long. Some of the same people that I canvassed are still members of that church, still making their pledges. And this whole matter, then, of why evangelical churches keep growing and continue to show the strength they have, that's really a topic for another sermon for another day, because it involves a myriad of reasons. But I can give you two quick ones before moving on. One is they're not afraid to talk about and ask for money, and they start doing it at a pretty early age. They know a lot about touching the generations and about keeping people faithful from one generation to the next. Well, when I think about all that's gotten me, from that time of my life to now, I really can't improve a whole lot upon the words of the late Jerry Garcia. What a long, strange trip it's been. And I've spoken about that trip plenty enough times I can leave it aside for today. But some things have remained constant with me on that journey. One is my ongoing gratitude for the lessons I learned at a very early age about institutional ownership, about having a sense that you're a part of something, that you're contributing to something that is greater than yourself. I remain grateful for what I learned about the value of extending one's personal gifts and one's worldly blessings beyond the bounds of the self. I'm glad I was given some sense of what it means to keep a gift going once you have received it and once you've been blessed by it. So on that note, and recalling some of the fine words that Chip has already offered us, let's consider for a moment the gift we've been given here. Some seven generations after it was created by those who founded this church in 1826, and the Universalist Church in Nashua in 1818. For these were people, some of them were among the town's most prominent citizens at that time, who believed that Nashua needed a Unitarian and a Universalist church. And they felt this way not simply for the sake of having religious institutions with those names attached to them, but in order for there to be a liberal religious presence in our community, so there'd be a place where people's lives could be nurtured and transformed, where the explorations of the human mind and the human capacity for reason would be celebrated and then joined with the needs and the yearnings and the desires of the human heart. They wanted there to be a place where the values and the principles that can cause us to become a more just, humane, and loving community and world, they wanted a place where those kinds of values could be cultivated and then spread beyond our doors. That was the vision that the Unitarians and the Universalists of this community over 180 years ago considered to be worthy and demanding and compelling of their time and their effort and their money to bring into being and continue to be given to future generations. And that gift has been placed in our hands now. If we tend to it well, if we grow it well, someday it will be in the hands of those who are not yet even born. Which means if we do what we need to be doing, those future generations someday will get to sit in these pews and listen to another sermon kind of like this one. That's not a privilege you would want to deny anybody, I don't think. But really now, think for a moment. Just think for a moment. How the gift, the Unitarian Universalist Church of Nashua, New Hampshire, and the gift of a liberal religious faith tradition whose origins well predate the founding of this church. Think about how they have blessed and continue to bless each of us. Think of the friends you've made here. Think of the ways in which your life has been touched and changed by all you've seen, heard, and felt as you've taken part in your journey with us, whether it's here in a worship service, where you felt a sense of uplift, you hear some of the wonderful music our choir offers, hear people share some of the most important parts of their lives, and all that goes beyond that. Probably some of you enjoy the fellowship you spent with your dinners last night. I know Michelle and I certainly did. Think of our children and our young people, and I mean our children and young people in the broadest sense of the word, those to whom, thanks to your help and support, we offer a religious education program that celebrates and upholds the very best in what it means to be a religious person. Hopefully gives them a life stance, a life framework, a set of values, principles that they can pattern their lives after as they become adults. And moving beyond this, think of the various groups and organizations in our wider community who benefit from the use of our facility and who are the recipients of our outreach collections that we take care every Sunday. Think about those, including many of you, who have been moved by way of being a part of this congregation to become advocates in a number of ways for what our Second Unitarian Universalist principle calls justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. When I've been involved in some of my own activities beyond the church here, whether maybe standing with a sign somewhere asking for the closest, quickest end to the war that we can come, or whether it's testifying, as I was proud to do last year up at the State House on behalf of equality in marriage for same-sex couples, any of these things. And I see other folks from this congregation, other UU congregations around the area. It just makes me very glad to be where I am and knowing that I have a support. Are not all these gifts worthy of the strongest support you can give them? Both for the generations that are represented here in this congregation right now, and for those whom we hope and pray and presume will come after us. I have a personal take on touching the generations I mentioned in my newsletter column for this month of February. For one of the joys of the now 20-year ministry I've been privileged to share with you has been seeing another generation of UUs come of age, a generation that includes my own son. It's a little hard to describe all of my feelings when I officiate a wedding or conduct a child dedication naming ceremony for young adults who were in grade school when I first arrived here. As I say, Bert, it was a joy to hear your message about your grandchild. I think Carrie was about 9 or 10 when I first arrived here. For in addition to the joy of the occasion itself, I also get a sense that, yes, we are doing something right here. Not just right, but something very significant and important and meaningful. We're offering a religious and a spiritual home that will hopefully last a lifetime, both for those who come into this home at a very early age and for those who discover it at a later part in their lives. And now it's time to get down to it. I'm going to reiterate some of what Chip has already said to you. This home, this gift, this very special place of hope and meaning and healing and love and justice is here because previous generations were willing to support it and keep it financially healthy enough to be handed off to us. So we can and we must do no less than those who gave this gift to us. In fact, if we put our minds to it, I'm sure we could do even more. When you go into the coffee hour today, you will find an envelope with your name on it and a table in the hallway. If it's not there, we have a stack of extra ones too, so do please pick one up. When you open it up, you're going to find, I think, 3 things in it. You'll find a letter from our president, Laurie Goodman, and myself, just talking about some of the opportunities and challenges that are before us at this point in our congregational life. You're going to find a pledge form, this one here, that you're asked to fill out, with an envelope that you can put in to either turn it in today, we'll have a specially marked box for that, or mail it back at a later date. And I hope you will also pay very special attention to the contents of a little green pamphlet that you'll find in there as well. It has a very simple and straightforward guideline chart as to what we hope you can offer by way of a pledge based on your family income. It shows how our sources of income, how where they come and where we need to be allocating and spending them. There's a list of frequently asked questions that we hope will cover any of the questions you have about our pledge drive. If not, feel free to speak to myself, Lori, Chip, our treasurer, Mike Wilk over there. I ask you to pay special attention to the place in here that Chip has already alluded to that deals with our endowment and the good news that we have in recent years been able to lessen our dependence upon it thanks to a healthy upturn in our pledge base. We need to keep going with that. We need to become even less dependent than we are. The good news is we're heading in the right direction. And we need those invested, because we need those invested funds to be sure that we cannot be overly reliant upon them if we are to continue to be the congregation we truly want and need to be. If you feel you're ready to make your pledge today, there'll be a specially marked box, as I say, to receive your pledge forms. If you feel you need some additional time to think about it and discuss it with your family, I ask that you do take that time. And I would suggest that you do discuss it, if you go this route, with all those family members that you feel it would be appropriate to do so. Unlike that little story I opened up with, we do not ask for separate pledges from people in our junior high and senior high youth groups. But if you have young people in your family, it's probably not too early to speak to them about what the meaning of a pledge is that your entire family will be making. Sooner we make young people a part of that process, the sooner the idea gets into their heads as yet another generation comes along. As Chip also said, we want to close this by the 20th of April in order to give our executive board the time it needs to prepare a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. I'm going to read just a couple of lines from that green pamphlet I referred to that pertain to the guidelines. I think they're of particular importance. They say, we have received many positive comments from people who appreciate the guidelines. Families and individuals pledging to the guidelines represent a substantial portion of our operating income. And then in response to a question about whether or not one can make them, this is what we say, and we certainly mean it. The amount you contribute is a personal decision, and the church is grateful for all the pledges we receive. So I'll end on this note. I know that you, all of us, you work quite hard for your family's income. You work in a very dedicated way to support yourselves, to support your families. If you're retired, you've probably got a life of dedicated work behind you that's gotten you to this point. I know you have to work, you have to plan, you have to come up with your own personal and family budgets, just as those parents of those junior high kids I canvassed half a century ago did. I know your financial support of this church is not something you take lightly. I've long appreciated the wisdom of Winston Churchill when he said, "We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give." This pledge drive is about making a life for ourselves, for our children, for all who are in need of a congregation like this one. So I ask you to do as much as you can to make it a deep, rich, and full a life as possible. Consider as well the figure that you put on the pledge form when you do decide that. It's all about you and not about you all at the same time. That's the paradox I'll leave you with. Of course, your pledge is about you, in that it's about the money you've earned. It's about the portion of what you've earned you're willing to share with us. But it's far more than being just about you. It's also about the kind of liberal religious community you and I and all of us want here for ourselves. And beyond that, it's about the kind of world we want to live in with all of those with whom we share this planet. It's about growing, in the closing words of our closing hymn, the fruits of love and peace and justice, where today we plant the seed.